Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. On today's podcast, we have Elliot Balch, the CEO of the Downtown Fresno Partnership. And I've known Elliot for a very long time, so this will be a fun conversation for me personally. Welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here.
Thanks. We have a bunch of topics we want to go through. I want to start with Bitwise. We had a sentencing that happened in the past couple of weeks, and I'm just curious, what's your perspective on what's changed downtown since Bitwise fell apart? I mean, are the changes greater than you expected, or was it overstated, its impact, its departure from downtown?
I always appreciated that there was an aspirational sort of tone and aspect of communicating where the region could go, what downtown's role was. My observation then and now continues to be that Bitwise showed up in downtown Fresno and other downtowns because of what downtowns are, rather than downtowns being those places because Bitwise was here. And fundamentally, I would say that the reality continues to be that downtowns, including downtown Fresno, are places where innovators are finding community. And that's true in this building, in the Sun Stereo building, you all, other tenants that are here. And then on a very practical level, we've observed there are four buildings that we're talking about, and three of them are owned by Will Dyke, who's a local developer who's had a lot of track record of successfully delivering projects. And so when Bitwise imploded a year and a half ago, he was immediately following up with all of those tenants and others to fill spaces. And as soon as 6 months later, he was sharing with me his tenant role, and over half of the tenants in the buildings were new since Bitwise had left. So I
had a friend that was renting space in there, and there was a price reduction in the cost, and then yep. It was a pretty seamless transfer from his point of view.
He was on it like white on rice, and almost to the point where it feels like the buildings are more successfully run now than they were before.
Something Will had told me a couple of years ago, I think this was still in the middle of the pandemic when every single city in America was struggling to fill any office space downtown. Although that's still true in a lot of cities. But Will was telling me that's not necessarily our problem downtown, that we actually fill Class A office space really easily. Is that still true? And could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think it becomes a matter of scale. So Sacramento is wrestling mightily now with, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands or millions of square feet of state and state-driven office space that's now gone remote. And so at that scale, it's one kind of problem. But I think for us, yeah, I observe the same thing he does, which is that we've got newer government tenant buildings that are completely full and have been consistently for year after year. So yeah, I think that there's a challenge and an opportunity, which is to have more than just the government sector as the industry anchor. So over the years, retail has drifted away, but not only retail, also finance, also law to a great degree. And so what I would observe is that over the next transitioning agriculture and coming from agriculture into things like agricultural technology, mechatronic devices and research that can create products that are bought by farmers all over the world, diversifying based on our agricultural base. That is an innovation-driven industry prospect for the Fresno region that relies on innovators finding each other. And so there's a role for downtown in that.
Could I say what's implicit in what I think you're saying?
Yeah.
For the not planners following along, is that innovation needs physical proximity.
Yeah.
And when companies are within walking distance.
Yeah.
The Silicon Valley effect. You're close to the other VCs. You're close to the other innovators.
Bitwise, as a real estate developer, thought of all of that happening within a mothership or within four walls of a building. The reality is that downtown is the place, and it's not necessarily just specific buildings within. So if you're a block or two away from another office that's walkable and you're meeting at third spaces, that's part of what downtown provides. Yeah. For an innovation ecosystem.
How does that value proposition change in a hybrid workforce economy? I know most government offices are now mostly full-time, but we're hybrid at Fresnoland. I think most private sector companies are.
Yeah. I feel like the history is not finished writing with all of that. And no doubt there will be less exclusive reliance on office space, but like equally no doubt there'll be still some role for people getting together to make stuff happen. The people that figure that out will have a competitive advantage over the people who are at home and not coming up with innovative ideas together.
Yeah.
What are the places in Fresno, Clovis that are competitive to downtown in attracting office workers?
I would say in this kind of space, it's a little bit scattered and there isn't necessarily that place. Like Parsec is in this building mm-hmm. as a downtown, but then you have other firms that are located throughout the metro area. And I think that the other thing I would say is that there should be an opportunity for higher ed driven research, Fresno State and UC Merced, to show up. And I think downtown is the place where that needs to happen as part of a larger ecosystem of university-led innovation that has wider economic consequences.
What about the 41 and Fryant? That's an area. Is that a competitor in your mind in that it's dense commercial real estate right there?
The competitor thing doesn't quite land for me because I think what's unique about a downtown, and again, you could say this about a lot of downtowns and ours is one of them, is that you have a mix of things that are going on and in one place. You have things that are work and office, you have residential, and you have retail, entertainment. We've got work to do in all of those fronts together, but there really isn't another neighborhood that even defines itself or aspires to have all those different things happening in one neighborhood. Things are one or two of those things without mixing it all together. And so it's just different.
Yeah. Another thing that was in the news last year that I'd love to hear you talk about is some of the homeless ordinances. We talked about this before we started recording. What have you noticed in terms of changes in downtown since those passed?
We've seen some good news. One of the struggles that we and the property owner had for a long time with folks at Kern and Van Ness is it's a corner where you have a privately owned garage that's wide open structurally, and there's always folks out on the sidewalk across the street. There's folks who park in the garage and work in the other direction across the street. So it's been this kind of complicated situation when folks do show up and camp out, in some cases set fires to warm up. And that's been a place where we've seen a real turnaround. Last month, heard from the property owner that he's not having to have tenant complaints or have to be there every day anymore dealing with issues cropping up at that location. And that's a very central location too. So I would say that's a pretty bright spot. It's not like there are magic bullets.
Yeah. In the aggregate, how are we doing?
Yeah, I think better. I think that having the resources of ordinance in place that the police can fall back on when folks do have unwelcome visitors causing problems in a business, for example, I think that's been a net positive, but it's not a substitute for having more of the housing that's needed and taking care of root causes of homelessness, for sure.
We also need to talk about Art Hop. That was maybe one of the bigger downtown stories last year, if not the big one.
Yeah.
We've been 4 months into Why Not Wednesdays. How is that going?
It's going well. I think that what we've seen is that there's folks that we're working with who are independent event organizers who see a lot of value in the concept alongside us and are really working hard to create something for the community that's different every month and that has really good bones and structure. And I would say that in addition to the success of Why Not Wednesday as its own thing, it's also a template and a model that anyone can look at and recognize this is a well-run, well-structured event that's going on. This is the kind of thing that can happen when there's a properly managed event. And so as we think about Art Hop and think about other nights of the month, as I've had this conversation with a number of people, there's nothing about Why Not Wednesday that is a threat to anyone. It would be a great thing to have happen on any other night of the month, including First Thursdays.
How many years do you think it's going to take to rebuild the foot traffic and crowds that we saw at our hop?
Oh, I don't know about years. I think that what we know about young people is people like to go out on certain nights of the week, and Fridays and Saturdays and Thursdays are those nights. And I don't think that standing up Why Not Wednesday is necessarily an alternative substitute for having good things happening on Art Hop. And as I talk to Art Hop venues, galleries that have been around for a long time, there are different crowds of people that may be coming to one thing versus another. And a commonality when I talk to different folks about all this is that everyone actually likes the value of having different crowds coming out. People are discovering things that they might not have been looking for.
Then why did they feel the need to separate them?
Yeah.
That was something I never fully grasped.
And I think, I don't know either, but I think that the opportunity, based on things that I hear from people in the downtown arts community as well as small businesses, there's a huge amount of overlap and common ground. Everybody, pretty much everybody, seems to agree that like having different kinds of things going on one night is a good thing rather than a bad thing, and that as long as it's clear that this is this and that is that, in the naming or however we talk about it, it honors the decades of work that people have put into building up Art Hop to be a great thing on its own. But that doesn't mean that it can't share the night with another thing that's going on that's bringing people out for other reasons.
What about the street vendors? That was a big concern when they split the event, that the people hurt most would be the vendors coming out. What have you heard from that community?
We went through, I know, a lot of talk out there about folks. The thing that always seemed missing from the conversation when this change was happening was that a lot of folks were paying vendor fees before. We were behind the scenes more, helping some of the organizers who had pulled permits for portions of the street fair that was happening along Fulton Street. And there were vendor fees involved with that. There were even wildcatters out there trying to charge fees, and in some cases successfully, for people to be out there. So we've had a transition, I would say, but we've learned in the course of Why Not Wednesday and tried some things. So it's not monolithic in terms of 10 by 10 booths. We also have an opportunity for artists or nonprofits to have just a table, and that is a more accessible option. And so we've had folks returning month after month. We've had folks taking advantage of the different kinds of vendor spaces, and those are good things.
Something you said earlier stuck with me, which is that there's this respect for the artistic community and the brand of Art Hop that they've built over time. And you and I have been around for a long time. We remember when Art Hop was Wine and Cheese Nights at, what's that, JP Marketing or whatever that place is called. Chris Sorensen's. JSA and at Chris Sorensen's studio.
Yeah.
I remember going to a house on Huntington Boulevard and having wine with a bunch of people I didn't know. and it's evolved for the good. And so I think the question I just remain having is, when something evolves so organically, why couldn't we just embrace that more? Right. Like, why did we need to dismantle
or iterate something on the parts that weren't working?
Yeah.
Right. I think I would just say where we are now, the opportunity that we have now is to solve the challenges that are very specifically like, how do we get back to what it is that we want? And so one of the conversations that we've been having at our board, like last month in December at the Downtown Partnership Board, was like very literally the impact on small business of Art Hop changing and not having that level of activity that was, by our measurements, 15 to 20,000 people in a night. Like, that can mean $30,000 to $40,000 collectively to businesses. And that might mean rent for the month. The thing that needs to happen in order for that to be able to get back onto a night where it can grow back to that scale, and I would say quickly rather than in a matter of years, because the demand is there and we know that it is. So in our research, which we had been sharing with the city in 23 and reflected in a Measure P proposal that we'd made in 20, we had taken knowledge that we had from operating street festivals at that scale to say, we think that the police and security budget's about $10,000 a month. So just based on experience, not so much we think, that's what it is.
Can I just pause you for a sec?
Yeah.
What was the flashpoint in the last year that catalyzed all of this to get to a point where we said we absolutely have to have police insecurity. That's a non-negotiable from here on out.
That's one example of the kinds of requirements that come on when you have a permitted event. The thing that had held us back, I mean, we were talking to the city in 2023 about what if this event were to become permitted so that the various issues that are in that we see can be a problem, whether that's insurance or the liability for like traffic collisions, if there's a vendor that's coming into the traffic lane and the city knows about it. If there was an attempt to address some of those issues by making it a permitted event, including a street closure, like what does all that look like? And so we laid out a budget, and so there's a few things, but the police and security is part of that.
But who and when, what was the deciding point where enough people, the powers that be at City Hall, said this has to be a permitted event, we cannot continue to go on? Because it happened really fast from our perspective, the public's perspective.
Right.
There was not an awareness that there was a boiling point. And I think that's part of the public consternation about Art Hop, is it was just boom.
Yeah.
It's done.
Yeah, I could see that. And it was ultimately a pretty fast decision in July that the city made. We had been pointing out some of the risk points for a longer period before that. Ultimately,
was it really just Miguel? Like, all right, we're switching it up.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And reset point. So I think what we've seen, as I say, like a positive is that with Why Not Wednesday, we've shown that a structured, managed event can provide real value. And there's no reason that anybody who's worried about the image of Art Hop, for example, should have concern about that being part of that night. Right? That would be my take on it.
So another hot topic I want to talk about downtown, we have this $50 million from the state and another promised $250 million that Newsom said in his last visit is likely going to happen. Is that, and we've talked about this before, but I think for everyone here, you should know that Elliot has been working on and off in your career for what, 20, 25 years on downtown revitalization?
21-ish.
21, not to be specific. But what about this money is going to be different than all the other things that have been promised to downtown that are going to be the thing that makes us get there? And what is there? Like, how will we know when we're successful?
That's a lot. So a lot to unpack there.
Yeah,
so,
give us the history of HUD, go through revitalization efforts in the 1960s. Let's go through the whole thing.
Start with
Jordan, help. These are part of the work I did at City Hall, less flashy than the Fulton Street project, let's say, or creating the PBID with the property owners. But we had Measure C infrastructure dollars for infill.
Yeah.
TOD, some of that money went into the Fulton Street project. But before that, there was other money available that went into some of the projects that people see around.
Redevelopment agencies.
It was in redevelopment times. Is that true? Yeah. But it was Granville projects that had alleys rebuilt or things like that, offsites, that got paid for by Measure C. And those were real costs against those projects that needed to be borne by somebody. So, you know, the question becomes, like, every dollar counts, right? So if you don't alleviate those costs from projects, then either the developer makes less money or the rents go up or the project doesn't go. So having infrastructure addressed is absolutely critical. And if you think about a building like the Penney's building, which was a big department store that had a handful of bathrooms, but now it's going to have 162 kitchen sinks and toilets, pretty big difference for what it means in the alley. So to imagine the project in addition to all of the project having to do that is a lot.
So it solves the offsite question, which has been a big question, but it doesn't solve the Granville projects. All were financed with redevelopment agency money, which we don't have anymore.
Yes. I've definitely been making that point to a number of people who maybe don't have the length of history that you and I have to know and to remember. Yeah, truly, what do we got? Maybe 600 housing units that have been built in the last 20, 25 years downtown. Mm-hmm. And gosh, what, less than 100 have been built after the redevelopment funded pipeline went away.
And to be clear to our listeners, the redevelopment agencies were a financing mechanism that took a little increment of tax revenue that was created off of property values going up, and it was able to be reinvested into places like downtown. And when Jerry Brown was governor, he got rid of them because a lot of redevelopment agencies misspent the funds. I think there's a famous mermaid bar in Sacramento that was part of the reason that we don't have redevelopment agencies anymore. Yeah. So corruption happened. We don't have that anymore. But it was a key piece of financing from the like 90s and 2000s and 2010s to get some of those projects built that we don't have anymore.
Yeah. So we have, you know, a number of these projects that were built that have market rate and affordable units. So the non-concentration of affordable housing, the mix of incomes, that's a desirable outcome. But the money that we're talking about, that Donnie's talking about, was unique and special in that it didn't trigger a prevailing wage, which increases the cost of building the project. And that money was also very patient in terms of how and when it would be repaid by the projects over a longer period of time. Those aspects are now harder to find in any of the policy discussions.
But there's another piece to us, too. Yeah. Every time I talk to other downtown people, they'll remind me the demand is higher than ever downtown. Mm-hmm. All the Granville projects still have wait lists. It's mm-hmm. hard to get, you know, certain types of office space downtown. So why can't that demand translate mm-hmm. to, is it that the rents would, that if you converted that demand into the housing, the rents would just be outside of everyone's price point?
Pretty much. So I remember this a few years ago that Fresno Housing would look at projects from their peer agencies in other parts of the state and see that the construction costs were maybe 85% of what they would be in those areas here. But the rents were maybe 40, 50% of what they would be in the Bay Area or LA or whatever. So there's, even if demand is strong, there's still a regional context for what demand, what rent you can charge and just where we are versus construction costs.
How has Sacramento been able to push through? I see them, they're like a peer city in some ways.
I would tell you, and LA's been, will tout that they've had the most production of any too. I would say that there's a role, when I think about what we're up against or what we're up to downtown, it is not just one thing in isolation like housing or innovation that we were talking about in terms of office uses or retail, which we could talk about. It's like all of these things together. And so back to the differentiator for a downtown, the differential thing is to have multiple different aspects of the economy going on in one place, unlike anywhere else. But to have value that shows up in rents that indicate people are really wanting to live there, those things all have to be working well. So there's like, we have to make progress on all these fronts together.
Kind of the collective action thing we were discussing maybe before we started recording, where you need a lot of things to happen at once in order for anything to go.
Yeah.
What's the biggest barrier at the moment? Is it really money?
It's never struck me that the problem is money per se. Like the money shows up when the pro formas work out and have to have, I think there's a couple of things. And you and I've talked about this over the years, is like how many developers are trying to solve these problems? How mm-hmm. many people?
Yeah, like two.
Two, right? So in a downtown, in a region, in a city, that there ought to be like 24 working on projects. So that is a real thing, I think, that's a part of our pipeline. But then just consistently investing in building up the desirability to where we do have affordable units, but we also have market rate units that are able to charge based on being in a desirable area, submarket.
Whenever we talk about has downtown made it, is downtown successful, everyone has their own vision in their head. It's, It's like you have this really difficult job of chasing a reality that looks different to everyone else. Mm. For me, it's I want good restaurants at a boutique hotel, just to be clear.
Yes.
So you know what's on my wish list for downtown.
Duly noted. Yes.
I don't know what's on your wish list, but how do you create a collective and achievable, like how do we know when we're successful?
Yeah, I would have the heart of, I'm not an economist, but I have the heart of an economist, which is a joke because economists don't have hearts. But the thing to me that I look at is if it's like the Donald Shoup approach to parking, which you probably both appreciate, is like the way to know if your parking program is successful is really by occupancy. So if you're like about 85-90% occupied, then your pricing and your management are about right. There's always like one space available for the next person who shows up. It's the theory. It's different from marginal revenue equals marginal cost, but it's a public good maximizing function. And I think about downtown in the same way is like you could look at occupancy/vacancy to see like how we're doing. Places can vary in terms of wealth and the price points in the market, but if you've got things working right and priced right and the demand is stewarded and all that, then you should be seeing occupancy of land and buildings that's in that range, 85-90%, let's say. So then we look around and like we see a lot of land that's developable, and so we're not there yet, or we've got existing building space, ground floor, Fulton Street, that has a lot of anchor retail and retail in general that's vacant. So we know that we've got work to do to occupy that space. I'm a little bit agnostic about how high or low the rent is or exactly what uses. I believe in the community and the market, some combination of the two to get to the right combination of things. I think that happens coming out of entrepreneurship, coming out of community, but high vacancy is not okay. That's the sign of health.
So the purpose of downtown should be an emergent phenomenon where it's discovered through people using the space rather than directed in the status model of this is where we want to take downtown in your mindset. That's how philosophically you think about it.
Yeah. I think your question leads to what is the role that we're supposed to be playing as the downtown partnership?
That's kind of where I was going. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's definitely work that we do that's important day to day, week to week, that can only happen by property owners and business owners working together to maintain the public realm. We do that with the city to market things that are going on downtown, highlight some of the stories and the businesses, to put on events that are in the public realm and serve the community and bring value to multiple businesses. Those are all examples of collective action. But so is like figuring out how to lease retail space when the kinds of spaces that are vacant, the tenants that would take those spaces are really interested in the group of tenants as opposed to just a one-off leasing transaction. So in that sense, then our job is to assemble the market in a way that no individual owner of any particular space or building could do on their own. Mm-hmm. So it's recognizing the rationale for why we exist and then recognizing that there's some other applications of it.
Okay.
Are we going to get a boutique hotel?
Yes. Donnie, we are. Because actually it turns out that boutique hotels are an example of a collective action problem as well. So a couple years ago, I was talking to a boutique hotel developer who happened to be walking Fulton Street with a couple of us. And there was a building we went into and he said, this building wants to be a boutique hotel. And I said, what's the model? Is it like community social enterprise? You got to try to maximize the profits because these things are inherently not profitable. But so then I asked, how do they happen? As often as not, more often than not, when boutique hotels are developed, there's some surrounding landowner or owners that come together to make it happen because boutique hotels,
they create restaurants.
Yes.
The Darling.
That's why I want them.
Padre.
I want the thing that creates the thing I want.
They ooze profit.
I'm not going to stay at this
everybody
hotel.
Else. Like,
If Visalia has the darling, Fresno should have a boutique hotel.
It's really a spirit of competition and good restaurants. That's why I'm not going to stay at this hotel, just to be clear.
So you actually, it's in a way much better to be the restaurant across the street mm-hmm. than to actually have to run the hotel.
But restaurants run on such small margins. Mm-hmm. So how do you get restaurant owners to be like, yes, we want this thing?
I would just say, and I don't know the mechanism exactly, but what I would say from the Downtown Partnership perspective, we're not quite there yet in being able to say how this happens, but in terms of the downtown economy, we're positioned in this place where we answer to all the property owners, right? So in a not necessarily exactly economic way, but in a pretty important way, we're answerable to the progress and the value that everybody feels in the area around. So we don't have the capacity today as an organization to build a boutique hotel, but I do feel like uniquely it's probably up to us or something like us to figure out the answer.
Because so is it happening?
Yes.
When?
I just don't know how or when.
I'm very dissatisfied with the answer.
Let me ask you, and what are you? The Fresno Land Inn.
We're not in the hotel business at the moment, but thanks.
I don't know. I have a reason I can articulate for why we would be involved in a project like that, or mm-hmm. a welcome center that is a state recognized thing that can help give some focus to visitation and tourism in an area that can happen in a downtown or say where freeways cross, and things like childcare. Even are things that the value of that is not fully measured within the four walls
of
the facility. It mm-hmm. creates value for every square foot of residential and office around it. So just some portion of this portfolio of inherently collective action type problem real estate assets is ultimately what we need to be part of helping solve.
Are you, as the new generations, Gen Z, Gen Alpha, they're behaviors are different than older generations. They drink less. Their ways of being are just different. Are you worried that there's an existential threat for downtown because of that?
No, I've observed the opposite.
Really?
We have seen so many young people at things like we were talking about Art Hop before.
Yeah.
Fueled by young people. And talking about how Brewery District businesses do as part of that mm-hmm. is that as well. So I don't know. It'd be interesting do we have data on like our local generations and the like nightlife and social and drinking behavior?
I have anec data, that's all.
Yeah. So I don't know about that.
I wonder, because when you talk to people in different generations, back to this concept of like, when is downtown successful? For some people, it's like the Bass Pro, which is clearly a boomer aspiration.
Yeah. I don't so
yeah. say that. I don't know about
you
that.
You say
either,
that,
Donnie.
But one of our vendors at Why Not Wednesday is selling a bunch of Bass Pro hats. And as I've been going around to different places like around the country and beyond in the last, I don't know, year or two, like I see all kinds of young dudes with Bass Pro hats on.
And it's mullets.
Not, look, yeah, just
no,
to be clear,
like,
I have nothing against Bass Pro, but why can't I just drive to River Park for my Bass Pro? Why do I have to go downtown for Bass Pro? You know what I mean? I don't understand.
How often are you driving to Bass Pro?
Never. Okay, just to be clear, I've never been.
Okay. All right.
I know it was a punchline like 20 years ago, but
I've heard it's making a resurgence.
The thing is, and I've heard this number. You've heard this number. I don't know how to count this high, that Fresno County has 400 lakes.
I haven't heard this.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Watch out, Minnesota.
Maybe I need to understand the definition of a lake.
There's a lot of little lakes. If you think about
ponds,
like the Potter Pass Trail, and then you pass five different lakes in a quick little loop. Like, there's a lot.
Minnesota needs to watch its back.
That's right.
I think everything moves in cycles. I think Gen Z is going to rotate. We're seeing it already.
And what I would tell you is go up sometime, not right now, but like in the summer, go up to Wishon Dam or something and look at who's fishing. And it's people that aren't necessarily from here. There's a lot of people from around here. It's a very diverse community of people. There's a guy who works in my wife's organization who has developed a whole program to take young men up to go fishing for change. And these like young men who are wearing Bass Pro hats on the bus, the plane, the wherever that I'm seeing all over the place are a very diverse set of, ethnically diverse set of young men.
I don't doubt this at all.
And it's,
I just have never understood the need to have a Bass Pro.
And it's women of color who are selling them at our event.
Totally. That's great. I just have never understood, like, why does a traditional suburban big box need to be downtown? Because maybe Bass Pro is not the thing. It's the, there's a perception that if the big boxes come, we will be successful. And why has that had some staying power?
Okay, let's think about Fulton Street. So there's about 400,000 vacant square feet. Of just north of 500,000. It's 80% vacant. And that, for reference, as a recent example, the outlets at Tejon are 365,000 square feet. So it's like a shopping center's worth of vacancy.
So then why do we build new shopping centers?
Yeah, and yet we are. So thinking about like the ability to support retail going into those square feet, the regional demand is there. The question is, where do we want it to happen?
Mm-hmm.
So
is it a marketing problem?
I'll get to that. But in those 400,000 square feet, about half of it is in spaces that are over 6,000 square feet.
Because this is a mall, basically.
Yeah, historically.
Yeah.
And like a third of it is in the former Gottschalk's building. So we did not build these places. We inherited these places. But it's also true that, so we have spaces that have now, I would say, proven themselves to be too big for local tenants to occupy.
Mm-hmm. And you can't partition them.
We have examples of kind of that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't create the regional draw power that having some national brands in the mix does. Mm-hmm. So it's not all, but in some of these spaces that are too large for local mom and pop tenants, the question really is, like, how do you fill this space? And the way to fill the space is with tenants that can take on a space of that size and have the draw that it takes regionally to do. When you do that, like you, if you start to see national brands in your retail mix, you think, oh, that's displacing some of our local folks. When actually what happens, like I talked to my counterpart in Pasadena a few weeks ago, if you go to Old Town Pasadena along Colorado Boulevard, you're gonna see a lot of national brands along Colorado. That's happened over time as that's taken shape.
Mm-hmm.
But what you don't see so much just driving through is there's 300 businesses there and 75% of them are local. And so the draw of the known creates the foot traffic that benefits the less known, the local, the smaller marketing budget business.
Mm-hmm. And that's true on Market Street in San Francisco. It's true in a lot of places.
It's true anywhere. And the thought experiment I put to folks is, imagine Fashion Fair and you came to one of the local smaller businesses in the middle and you said, great news, we're going to get rid of your competition at Macy's and empty that out. I'm like, that would not be good news. You know, there's a symbiotic relationship that needs to happen, but the spaces that we're talking about that are the largest have been the ones that have stayed vacant the longest. In some cases, longer than any of us have been alive.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, at this point, we've had the Fulton Street project, which increased real taxable sales substantially, which has increased foot traffic substantially, but has not changed vacancy. And we've had lots of other things going on too. And so it's time to organize the market a little better. And there's some work that we're doing to work with all the different property owners, again, in a way that I think is uniquely ours to do, to be able to market the different spaces together in a way
Do you think if we just stopped building more retail space, that would solve the problem?
More retail space, like regionally? No, because we haven't organized the market of space that we have. The supply that we have is not organized.
Mm-hmm.
So tenants that are in the market for the kinds of spaces that we're talking about are very interested in the mix, the co-tenancy, the who else.
Yeah.
The synergistic,
yeah,
you know, sharing of the customer.
Right.
And so when you are developing, think it's changing to thinking about what we're trying to do as development.
Yeah.
If you are developing retail, and this is happening, as you say, in other places in our metro, as we speak, it's the same everywhere. It's like herding sheep, or it's sheepdogging. You get one initial interest from one tenant, and then you go to other tenants and say, hey, I got them. Will you sign on? And they say, okay, we'll do a letter of interest. And you go back to your first letter of interest and you say, hey, I got these others. Will you firm up as a lease? They're very interested in the co-tenancy.
Right.
And so if you
But it's a lot of poaching.
Not necessarily, because we have...
What's being poached?
We have...
Trader Joe's.
Okay. We have things that are not in the region.
Yes, that's true.
That are openings in the market. So what I would just is that the value of a given space changes when the question goes from being, would you, tenant, rent this space, sign a long-term lease for this space, question mark, period, as a one-off, versus would you be interested in being the 40th out of 40 tenants in this area that we fill if we got the other 39 signed on?
Got it. So you're doing that developer work in conjunction with property owners.
You're doing risk mitigation with tenants, because if there's 40 tenants there, their risk goes down in terms of success.
Yeah, it's
right?
It's not so much risk. There really isn't any risk for the property owner in collaborating this way.
Oh, I meant for the vendors or the occupants.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah, because it's risk mitigation, but it's also value creation. So it's having 40 tenants together is a much longer, wider draw to a much larger region of market than one thing alone.
Is this how other downtowns are arranging themselves, if you will?
I don't know. The evidence that I have is not really. Like, I've heard about something in Midtown Manhattan that's similar. But I think that we perhaps somewhat uniquely have more diversity of ownership and more of these large spaces than average.
Do we have a speculation problem?
In terms of?
Property owners not doing things?
Yeah. See, for a long time, I've thought either that or that we have just a non-interested, non-responsive broker community that won't show these spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've come to understand is that the actual value of the space changes if you have a collective action approach. So as much as I might get frustrated with brokers, or in some cases frustrated with property owners, or any number of frustrations that I might have, the reality is that being frustrated is not going to solve the problem. What's going to solve the problem is that you change the equation that people are trying to solve.
And the property owners are going along with it.
Yeah.
And working with you.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yep.
When should we see results?
It's going to take a while. This is development.
We're going to conclude with our favorite segment, which is what we're loving this week. I'll go ahead and start first. So when it's cold outside, I want big novels. And Elliot and I were just talking about our time with the Russians over the holidays. I spent mine with Vasily Grossman and his novel called Life and Fate. All 870 pages occupied my holidays. It's an incredible story of essentially War and Peace Part 2 that takes place in Stalingrad. I don't know, when it's cold outside, I just want to get wrapped up in a big novel and disappear for a week or so. And so I really enjoyed that this week. Elliot, what are you loving right now?
Yeah, riffing on the Russian thing, I've been listening to Anna Karenina on audiobook, and it's been just delightful. Yeah,
and you're able to keep track of everything. Because when it comes to big novels, I almost have to have the book in my hand,
right,
or I start to lose like some kind of like almost tactile attachment to the plot and structure. You're able to keep that in
your head? There's definitely a family tree in my head as I,
okay.
Gotcha. As I listen to the different storylines. Yeah, yeah.
I would need the visual when I re-pick up Anna Karenina at some point. I'm reading House of Mirth by Edith Wharton. Because I'm a pop culture nerd, I'm reading it because Gossip Girl, yes, that Gossip Girl, was inspired in part by House of Mirth. And also Age of Innocence and other Edith Wharton things.
Have you watched The Gilded Age, the HBO show?
No.
You should watch it. It's an incredible. We don't get a lot of Gilded Age content in that space. We should. It's a really interesting time. And
I love history. That time period of history, and I love social commentary, and so it's wonderful. I've been devouring it.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.